A great privilege to worship again on this Mother's Day and to recognize that the purpose of our so doing, as it is to honor mothers, is certainly to remember that we are here to focus on the Lord and to give Him all the glory. But today I want to talk to you, and we want to move aside to this passage today to talk about how we are to view mothers and how we're to again assess the role of mothers within the home. And by the way, there is a grave difference. We'll talk about this in some sharp rebuke. When I was 23 and preaching Mother's Day messages, it was getting up there telling mothers how they ought to do kind of stuff. I am sorry and repent of that. At this stage of life, I want to affirm, if you will. And so here we go. In the process of this, though, this is important because we come back to the pyramid again to remind ourselves that the crucial issue for us is right here, biblical principles, but so much of it ties in how we use the properties God has given to us with respect to widows and to those whom God has ingratiated us with in the parents He's given to us. But here, the biblical principle. What is God trying to teach us? Especially as we look at this passage together today. Now, in this regard, I want to set the context for you. This is Ephesus, if you will. The author here is Timothy. Notice, if you will, chapter 1. He introduces this, Paul, an apostle of Christ Jesus. Now notice in verse 2, to Timothy, my true child in the faith. So this is Timothy. Notice Paul says in verse 3 of chapter 1, I urged you upon my departure from Macedonia to remain on at Ephesus. But by the way, that word urged is interesting. Keep that in mind because we'll come back to it a while. It is to urge or to encourage you. Didn't command him to, he encouraged him to. Notice also he says in chapter 4, verse 11, and we go now to the context of this, and notice in chapter 4, verse 11, prescribe and teach these things. And it's interesting, then he says in the next verse, don't let anybody look down on your youthfulness. Now it's important here. By the way, I have NIV up here because, not a problem, I'm not, I apologize, because I don't have all my books available. All I had available to me was NIV when I was doing this, so you get NIV here, okay? Don't let anyone look down on you because you are young. So this is a young man. A young man involved in ministry, Paul's true son in the faith. Now Paul has ministered in Ephesus a long time, but notice what happens. He's saying to this man, Timothy, I left you in charge, but look at verse 12. Let no one look down your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, love, and faith and purity, show yourself an example. So set an example, Timothy. In speech, in life, in love, in faith, in purity. Then 4:14, do not neglect the spiritual gift given you, which was bestowed on you through a prophetic utterance. So now, all of these things to Timothy. And then notice he says in 4:16, watch your life and doctrine closely, persevere in them, because if you do, you will both save yourself and those who hear you. And it is that upon which this background is set. Now watch this, because herein lies the challenge. Your name is Timothy, or whatever your name may be, okay? You have been left in charge of an established church in which your father of the faith has ministered extensively, i.e. Paul. In this regard, you are gifted and are placed in a place of leadership with people your own age and older. Okay, so this is the context. You might find yourself a bit intimidated, as Timothy would seem to have been, but if you're not intimidated, you may be a bit frustrated. And the reason for this is because you want to express your leadership even to people who are older than you are. Okay? How are you to do this? And yet at the same time show the proper respect and honor to them. And thus, chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. Now, as I deal with this passage, one of the things that is true, it's addressed here is in chapter 5, 1 and 2, it's addressed to different categories of people as to age and sex. Older men, older women, younger women. And it's significant because the first category is to age and sex, but from then he will then move to a category of widows, those who are truly so. He's going to do that in verses 3 and following. But I want to address these first two verses with you first, but in doing so, here's the principle. And let me start with a principle, a very significant principle in this passage that you have a hard time missing, no matter how you do it. By the way, this passage is difficult. And I'm not going to go down and identify all the problems and solve them. I'm just going to tell you the conclusions on the way through. And then you can do as you will with them. And I will address some of the problems that come in here. But you know what? One of the things in here you can't miss is the strong relationship between the family of God. That's this family right here. And the families of God. No doubt. It's too often we have not made the connection. So much of this book goes back to how you function in the household of God. This is, we so often look at this as the corporation of God. No, this is the family of God. The corporation of God is our 20th and 21st century imposition upon the church. This is the family of God. And how we function in the family of God certainly affects how we function in the families of God, does it not? And let me go in reverse. How the families of God function in this body strongly affects the family of God as a whole. It just does. You can't separate the families from the family or the family from the families. Can't do it. It has been the disturbing thing. Just let me do this as a background. If I'm going back to chapter 3, the requirements to be an elder are all related to the home. Nothing related to the company or the corporation for which you worked. And I remind you, because when I first became involved with many of you, one of the men who was the chairman of the board came to me one day, and we were seeking new leadership, and he says, I think we ought to make John. Actually, it was John. I think we ought to make John a board member. I says, why? He says, because he's owned his own company. And I says, and what does that have to do with anything? But listen to you, the problem. The trouble is the qualifications all come from the home, but we don't run the church like the home. And therefore, one says, okay, I know what I do in the home, and I come here to the church, but it functions so differently. It hadn't ought to function differently. This is the family of God, not the corporation of God. It is the family of God. And how one functions in the families of God affects how one functions in the family of God, and vice versa, it does. As this passage so clearly says. So what one learns from the one strongly affects the other, without a doubt. And by the way, I guess we go the other side. What one does negatively, wrongly, in one can strongly affect the other as well. Now, with regard to that, it is interesting because as we do this, the categories listed are relative to age and sex. Older men, younger men, older women, younger women. Now what's fascinating here, he starts this, do not sharply rebuke. You know, this word is only used here in the New Testament as strong. It is a strong term. In fact, as we stated here, it's almost a violent word. Now, it's interesting because he says, don't do this. Don't do this. Now, I'm going to say this to you later, but it's interesting because the heading of this section in chapter 5, verse 1 and 2, those verbs that are there, strongly rebuke and appeal, Those verbs apply to all of them, whether the older, the younger, the so forth. He doesn't repeat the words again. He just does the categories. So we start this business. Understand, it is not ours. You're a young man today. Listen to me carefully. Don't ever sharply rebuke an older man, an older woman, a younger woman in the body of Christ. But now, look at this. Well, what are you supposed to do? It's interesting because what he says to do is to appeal to them is the word that's used. It is this word here. Now, I want to talk to you about this word. It's made up of two Greek words. The one of them, it's interesting, it is the verb. The one of them is the verb to kaleo, to call, and the other is para, alongside of. Now, let me tell you something about this. Whatever you do with this term is coming alongside of someone to do it. When I look at this term, I keep going back to my brother who was an English professor but also a track coach. And I would go to cross-country meets just to support him. And they would, when there was a home meet, they would run around the park twice. And they came up to the top of the hill the second time, around the same place where they started, and there were two ropes there which the runners were to run in between. And the coaches were not allowed to run in between, but they ran alongside of this as those who were running for their team would run, and they would come alongside and call out to them. They would call out to them words of encouragement. You're doing a good job. Just keep it up. They would call out to them words of exhortation. You know, you're not positioned right, and you're not going to make it unless you get moving a little faster. Or then I watched a fellow one day start out with shin splints, his legs so wrapped up, trying to just for the team's sake make it, and he had to drop out, and words of comfort were given to him. All of those this word can mean. Comfort, encouragement, exhortation. But all from alongside of, not yelling at somebody, not barking at somebody, but coming alongside of. Now, it's interesting because whatever the translation of it is, it has the idea of coming alongside of and calling out to. Now, when you put this in perspective, it's interesting because it can mean to summon or ask. It can mean to comfort, encourage, request, or urge. It is used of encouragement, urging, requesting. In fact, I take you back. It is interesting. Go back with me to chapter 1 again, verse 3. And I'll take two words side by side, which are interesting. I urged you, verse 3. It could be I encouraged you. I didn't command you. I encouraged you, I urged you. This is the same verb exactly upon my departure. See, I didn't make you stay at Ephesus. I encouraged you to stay at Ephesus. But notice this, in order that you may instruct. The word instruct is this word, is command. It's a different word. Now let me tell you why that's important here is because. What is he supposed to command here? Not command people in the church, but command opponents. Notice, I left you that you may command certain men not to teach strange doctrine. But now, walk with me here again, because in summary, there's a marked contrast between how he is supposed to respond to opponents, people with false doctrine, and how he's to respond to people in the body of Jesus Christ, the family of God. Sharp contrast. In verse 3 of chapter 1. Now, what's significant here, he is to encourage and to urge, not to strongly rebuke. Now, when you think about that, someone has put it this way, there's a difference between how Timothy and Titus should deal with opponents and how should they deal with others in the church. In dealing with opposition, they're to command, to speak with the authority given by God. But in speaking to others, they're to be gentle, urging and encouraging proper belief and conduct. I probably read that when I was younger, but I should have read it a whole bunch more times. I was young like Timothy, talking to older men. And I think I showed respect, but you know, I'm not so sure it was always this way. Walk with me further, because Here's the idea. Don't stand over people, Timothy, and rebuke them, but rather gently encourage them to walk as they should. It involves gentle persuasion rather than browbeating. It should not be one of domination, but rather of encouragement. Now walk with me. Go with me just back two books. You're in 1 Timothy, go to 1 Thessalonians if you will. Go with me to chapter 2. Look at, Paul doesn't just say to do it, Paul does it this way. I start in verse 10 of chapter 2. You are witnesses, and so is God, how devoutly and uprightly and blamelessly we behave towards you believers. But notice, just as you know how we were, and here is this word, by the way. I would translate this way, encouraging and comforting and imploring each one of you as a father would his own child. I dealt with each of you as if I was your father and you were my child. And in the first two words, the one is to comfort, the other is to encourage, and the third is to implore. I think as a father too often I implored before I encouraged and comforted my children. I think so. And for that, I'm sorry, truly sorry. But you see the need. Now walk with me. I want to take you somewhere. Go with me to 2 Thessalonians. I'm going to come back to 1. 2 Thessalonians is only a few pages over. Go with me to chapter 3. In verses 6 and following, he's dealing with disfellowshipping people from the body. Notice what he says in verse 6. We command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you keep aloof. Separate yourself from every brother who leads an unruly life. Notice verse 14. If anyone does not obey our instructions, this letter, take special note of them and do not associate with him so that he may be put to shame. Boy, that's pretty strong. You know what? Go back with me to 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. The same problem that they're dealing with in 2 Thessalonians 3. They're going to have to disfellowship some of these people. But look at how Paul addresses the issue in verse 9. He wants to address the very same problem, a serious problem in the church. But look at how he begins it. He doesn't start off saying, get with it. No, he looks in verse 9. Now as to love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you. Why? Because you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. Affirmation. And notice this next statement. Not only did God teach you to love, but look at in verse 10. Indeed, you are practicing it toward the brethren who are in all of Macedonia. All the brethren, all of Macedonia. How affirming can that be? This is a serious issue. Months later, he will say, disfellowship yourself from these people. But look at how he begins this, encouraging them, affirming them. And then even at the end, he says, we urge you, brethren, just excels more. Listen, even a more serious issue, we start with affirmation and encouragement. How does the family of God affect the families of God? And how do the families of God affect the family of God? Never, he says to Timothy, and he's talking to him personally, this is not to the church, it's to Timothy, never sharply rebuke an older man, but encourage him in his walk with God. Huh. Now, it's interesting because when you look at this, then that's the issue, by the way. Go with me now, if you will, to this passage. One of the things is this, older men. And I'm back to 1 Timothy chapter 5. Do not sharply rebuke an older man, rather encourage him as a father. Appeal to him as a father. Urge him as a father. You know what? If there is a problem with this culture, it is the lack of respect. You know, it's interesting because we're going to say, carry over what you do with your father into the church. The trouble in this culture is that so much of what we do with fathers, we don't want to carry over into the church. I was raised in Africa, as you know, raised in a culture where there was an unbelievable respect for people, older people. You know what? Elders, the elders of the church used to sit up here in pews like this, and you called an elder an alagba. You didn't say alagba, though. You said alagba. There was reverence in your tone. And those of you who are older, I would never speak your first name, nor would you ever speak mine. Not even those who are younger than I. I would never call Mr. Newsom or Mrs. Newsom by their first name. Wouldn't do it. Absolutely would not do it. I would call them Baba Dylan, Mama Dylan, but I would never call them by their name. I can call their son's name. I cannot call their name, see? Respect. You know the stupid thing? You're in Africa. It's their country. They show up to attend the seminary where you teach. And we, beautiful people, the first thing we say, what is your last name? Well, their last name is their father's first name. That's how they did it. I would have been Donald Stewart, my father's name. And my last name would have been Stewart. And by the way, that was the practice way, way, way back when. But then they decided we just hook on to the Father McDougal, Father Dougal, and Dougal would carry all the way down. So I am the son of Dougal. But you see, I would have been Donald Stewart. And you asked me to say my father's first name, it would be the first time I'd ever spoken it. But since you're an American and you asked for it and I want to get into school, I give it to you, you see. Now, I raised in Africa, I'm teaching in Africa, and I look at a student one day, and I'm thinking I'm being respectful, and I say, Mr. Sule. Huh. He says to me, I'll respond to that, but nobody in this class will ever call me by that name, because I spoke his father's name. Graduation tonight. And it's funny because we Americans, you see, when you do a diploma, you hand it to them with the left hand, you shake the right hand. Do you know what? They would never take any of their left hand, ever. They take it with the right hand. And if it's something very special, they take it with both hands, but never with the left hand. Oh, we Americans, though, there's the right way to do it. You hand the diploma, the greatest thing they've ever received in their life outside of their salvation. You hand this to them, they take it with their left hand. You know what? I finally realized, I said, guys, why not give them the diploma first and let them take it with both hands? Then they can switch it to the left hands and shake hands if you want to, see? No, it's amazing how we impose this culture upon that, but we have so much to learn from that. And when I hear younger people, I just tell you where it is with me. This isn't a doctrinal issue, it's just a personal issue. I would never let my children call any one of you who are older by your first name. It wouldn't have happened. They still don't, more than likely. Why? I remember one time I talked about that in church. I didn't say you should do it. That's just something, personal preference, because I want to teach my children respect for those who are older. And we leave that and go to Sunday school class afterwards. And somebody, a seminary student's wife, says, if they don't call by my first name, they're no friends of mine. And I thought to myself, okay, I could care less. That's how life's going to be. They're not going to call you by your first name. By the way, I'm pastoring at all of 21 years of age, right across town here. And dear Mr. Marriott walks out. I says, Mr. Marriott, how are you today? And he says, my name is Paul. Okay. Listen to me carefully. Whatever you do in your home, be careful how you treat older men in the church, okay? Just be careful. Timothy, you're young. These are older men. You're a leader, but be careful. Be careful. Be careful. For how you function in your home, you function in God's home. But you see, how you function in God's home should be something that's reflected in your home. Treat older men with respect. Don't ever sharply rebuke, but encourage and urge, but never rebuke. Never rebuke. The next one is interesting, by the way. For he says, And younger men, now this is fascinating because now you're younger men, there are younger men in the church, but see, this is funny because I'm sitting at the table last night at this banquet and graduation, and a student right across the table is graduating this year, and he's just been called to a church, and he will start in the beginning of June. And the family is discussing, his in-laws and his parents, discussing what they should call him, see. I'm all of 21, and I am as insecure as life can be. I want you to call me pastor. Now, I could care less what you call me, as long as you call me in time for dinner. But you hear the point of maybe it's amazing what we do with this business. So now you're dealing with younger men, and your name's Timothy, and these guys are young guys. But see, I'm the pastor here. On the phone with a man this last week, former student of mine. He's in a church with a former student. This man owns his own business and therefore is able, free to do ministry in the church without any encumbrance. And he says to the pastor, I am the greatest asset you have, and it's true he is. But he says, the pastor's threatened by me. And we went to school together, we were in classes together, we came out of the same church, we were planning this church together, but he wants to run it like a dictator. See, one younger man to another younger man, intimidated by him, but he's the pastor and wants this man to remember he is. No. Your younger man, deal with younger men just like they were your brothers. Are you with me? This is no so over-under thing. Now, he goes on to the older women. By the way, it's the only time this term is used in the New Testament, so it was a female form of the older men. And deal with them with the kind of respect that you do with your mother. One person thinks that actually what they want to do is call the mother so-and-so, but let's not go there. But the interesting part of this, he comes to younger women, and it's fascinating. Look at what he does with Timothy. Timothy's a young man. Notice the younger women as sisters, and then he adds something that he didn't add the others, in all purity. Timothy, you're a young man. There are young women in the church. Be careful how you deal with them. I reflect on this passage and think of people over the years. I was in a wedding many years ago. And the young couple left here and went up to Northern California, got a church up there, and the pastor ran away with this fellow's wife. How do you do that if you really believe that you're going to treat them like you would your own sister? Your own sister, you protect her. Your own sister, you honor her. Your own sister, you make sure that everybody else honors her. And so he says to Timothy, be careful, my friend. I'm going to add something to this relationship. And as a man, and by the way, it's interesting in Titus. This is a fascinating thing for those of us who are in ministry. And for those of us in ministry, sometimes you think, you know, it needs the word of the pastor. Since when? Titus, I want older women to teach younger women. I'm not asking you to do it. I want them to do it. In a church that many of us were part of. When I first became the pastor of that church, it must have been the way it was set up because there were people who made an appointment to come see me. And so there was an appointment. I didn't know the person, but the person walked in, and it was a lady. And those shorts were shorter than I cared for, and those buttons weren't being used expeditiously on the blouse. And I said to the secretary after that, no more of this. If they want to talk to somebody, they talk to my wife. And if they won't talk to my wife, they won't talk to me. It's as simple as that. We don't need this. I don't need it. Timothy, be careful. Titus, be careful. Okay? So in the context of this, that's the first part of this. But walk into the second part with me because we'll never get through here. But notice this. The next part is the need to show honor. And when he starts in verse 3, he says, honor widows who are widows indeed. Now it's interesting because the thought of honoring those different ages, honoring widows, honoring elders, honoring masters. And by the way, the same related word is used in these last three. Understanding it's used in a different way, but the same related word, honor. But what's interesting, by the way, it's in the singular. It's not to the church, it's to Timothy. Timothy, you're a young man. Honor the widows. It's fascinating here because the key phrase is this, honor true widows. Now, I've given the Greek and the English simultaneously here because I want you to see something. Notice, if you will. Here's the word widows here. Twice in here. Widows starts, widows ends. Widows starts, widows ends. It's how it is in the Greek. And so he puts the widows first, he puts the widows at the end, because he wants to emphasize this is about widows, no doubt about it. And the whole emphasis of this passage is honor widows who are truly widows. Now, the primary purpose here is not, just so we understand this, it is not to tell the church you need to get with it because they were already getting with it. It was to give guidelines. So now, as we deal with this, keep that in mind. See, it's still Timothy personally he's addressing. He will broaden it to the body, to his true, but it's Timothy he's talking to. Give honor to widows who are widows indeed. Now, when we look at this, three groups are referred to here. Widows' families, look at the verse 4. Widows' families, but if any widow has children or grandchildren. The other one is godly widows. Notice them in verse 5. Now, all she is a widow indeed, and who has truly been left alone, fixed her hope on God. Then in verse 6, the ungodly widows, or the impious widows, you see. So all three parties are here, understand this. But, having said that, because he intertwines this, this is the issue of it all. Honor widows who are widows indeed. Don't get carried away with all these other things. Understand they're there, but this is the point. Take me further. Family responsibilities are in this passage, no doubt. These are secondary themes. Church is non-responsibility. The church is not responsible to take care of everybody. They just aren't. But the church is responsible to take care of these widows who are widows indeed. But don't, in the midst of this, lose sight of this. Okay. Now, I want to come back to this again. Walk with me, because what is the principle we're in trying to learn here? First of all, I want to start with this. Again, back to this. There's a strong relationship between the family of God, the visible physical church, and the families of God. Evident in this passage, how the family of God functions strongly affects how the families of God function, and in reverse, how the families of God function strongly affect how the church functions. So what one learns from one strongly affects the other. Now, here, the priority of the families of God. Very important matter to keep in mind. He's primarily dealing with the family of God's relationship to widows here. That's what he's dealing with. But three times he stops himself to introduce the families. Look at first, for example, start in verse 3. Honor widows who are widows indeed, but stop for a while. That's my primary point. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to practice piety. Look at verse 7, prescribe these things as well so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own. And so what he does, he stops in here. This is the primary issue. How the church cares for widows. But I want to deal with the but for a while, okay? And reminding ourselves again this, I can't say it enough. This is where it is. Okay, here we go. Two basic emphases, the priority of the families of God and the place of the family of God. Let us start with the priorities of the families of God. This is interesting. Look at this. He does this whole passage, right? Now notice what happens when he gets to verse 16. If any woman, now by the way, is a believer. Now let me just go to the Greek text with you just for a bit, because it's easier for me to do this right now. It says that if you have a believing woman, now some decide, let's change this because it can't be that. So they put pistos kai piste, if there's a believing man and a believing woman, and they have. No. This is just a believing woman. Now, why it is, I have no idea, but that's what it is. If she has dependent widows. Now, what's interesting, it's plural. Here's the sum of, there's so much speculation about this passage, it's unbelievable. So I'm not going there, but let me just tell you, some have suggested what happens is this widow decides, you know what she's going to do? It's like foster widowing, right? Foster homes. She's going to have all these widows in her house, but the church is going to help support them. It's like the state helping me support this business I have. That's not what this is about. At least it certainly isn't stated here. This woman has widows, more than one. Oh my goodness. Go with me somewhere back and then I come back here again. Look at chapter 5 and verse 4. If any widow has children or grandchildren, isn't it interesting? All of a sudden we're broadening this thing big time. If you're sitting here today and you say, okay, I'm not the child, I'm the grandchild, you have a responsibility to your grandparents. You do. Biblically, you do. But what's fascinating, so he carries it all the way down to grandchildren. This isn't just Mother's Day, it's Grandmother's Day. And it goes beyond this, but he takes this, he says, if this woman, it's a believing woman, has widows. May I suggest to you, and I can't prove it because nobody can, may I suggest to you, if this believing woman has widows in her home, it may well be her mother and her mother-in-law. Try that one out for size. We now have grandkids in here. We have mother-in-laws in here. Listen, if you have a mother or mother-in-law, you are responsible for their care. It isn't the churches to take care of them. Now, by the way, this church was taking care of all these people, and this church was having a terrible time, and we don't know why it happened. We just know, by the way, this is a big issue to God. You know that. Old Testament, widows and orphans, big time. James, pure religion undefiled is this, what? Visit fatherless and widows in their affliction and keep oneself unstained from the world. No doubt in God's economy, widows must be cared for. But Paul says, not widows who are members of families who should be taking care of their own. You remember when the Pharisees came to Christ? He rebuked them. He says, you know what happened? Your parents are retired. I'm adding that part a bit, but okay, your parents are retired. We know their parents, they need help. And they said, we can't give the money to God, to them because we've already committed it to God, see? It's korban. It's gifted to God. And therefore, because the money is gifted to God, I can't take care of my parents. Jesus says, you've forgotten the commandment, honor your father and your mother. And by the way, honor in this passage isn't just respect them, it's do something for them. No doubt throughout this entire context, it isn't just say, I honor you, I bow. No, do something for them. So as you look at this, is fascinating because in verse 16, the fact is you've got a woman, a believing woman, who has widows, possibly her mother and her mother-in-law in the house. She is to assist them and let not the church be burdened so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. Take care of your own home. Now, we did talked about the survey was done not long ago in this country, actually before the last elections, actually. Asking people, young couples across this country, their feeling, they would rather, young couples, not older couples, young couples would rather be taxed more by the government and have the government take care of their parents than to feel the personal responsibility of doing so. That may be a part of this government, but it's not a part of the Bible. Take care of your own. Notice something else in here. Priority of the home. Notice the piety of the home because he says it in verse 4. Notice this. He says, take care of widows, but if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first, look at this, first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family. I passed a sign yesterday with my wife and I didn't make note of it, but there was a sign of a Christian organization. The man who ran that Christian organization was known all over the world. But he neglected his family to do that. His daughter has since written a book just ripping on her dad. You know what? You first practice piety at home. It's where it begins. And so he starts with that, and he says, you know, it starts with, but notice this statement too. He then noticed the priority in the home in verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith, worse than an unbeliever. Why is he worse than an unbeliever? My friend, look it out there. They want to call themselves Christians. That's how they're doing to market themselves these days. But you may not believe like the Mormons believe, but they are committed to taking care of their own, are they not? See, even those who are unbelievers care for their own. Why in the world does the church not do so? That is, I must move on though. Watch this now, because let it walk with me, because the place of the family of God, the need to show honor, and I would just say to you, I want to talk about this, the need to show honor must have tangible manifestation. You look at this passage, do something for them. It's back to James. Don't tell them go and God bless. Do something. Do something. But now, watch this, because the major part of this passage is the guideline. People notice he's going to give, and I'll walk through these quickly as we conclude. Watch this, the guidelines for this. People are committed to God. What kind of widows do we do this? By the way, this doesn't say give them money in the church so they can do this. That's what some people suggest. Not true. Not true. This is people who have this lifestyle. Verse 5. The kind of widow, the widow indeed we're talking about from verse 3 is found in verse 5. She's been left alone, but she's fixed her hope on God. You know, I didn't reflect, but I'd reflect now. I had such a mother. That's true. I was blessed. God, for whatever reason, took her husband from her in what the world calls an accident on the mission field. She never did remarry. Very committed to him. But what, I'll tell you what. Some church missionary, there was no money asset set aside. Some church up in Oregon, they decided to buy a life insurance policy for my dad for $5,000. The pastors who came in subsequent says, no, you shouldn't do that. So finally ended up one Sunday school class just doing it. It was too much out of the ordinary. So when my father died, my mother had all of $5,000. You know, it's a beautiful thing, because you have widows indeed who fixed their hope solely on God. Now, hear me carefully. You see, the interesting part of this, their hope is placed in God, not in the family of God. They don't place their hope on the church. They don't place their hope on their families. And they don't place their hope in the government. They may get help from the government, they may get help from the church, they may get help from the families, but their confidence is in God, right? You praise God if these others come through, but the confidence is in God. And I look around this body today. See, I singled my mother out because she's in glory and not here, but I could go around this body today, people whose confidence is in God, who knows that that is why there's a provision made day after day, week after week, month after month. You see, help should come from the family of God and the families of God. It should come from there, but the confidence is not there. The confidence is in the God who provides. I cannot say enough to you, all of us. This is a godly woman, and many of us know such women. But I say this to all of us, our confidence must not be in anything but God. Don't place your confidence in anything but Him, exclusively. But anyhow, let me go on. The second thing is they were committed to prayer. You love this. This isn't something, by the way, some people think they give them money so they can pray. That's not what it is. This is a character of their life before this happened. And notice she has been left alone, but she's fixed her hope on God. And the evidence of this, she continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. You want someone to pray for you? This is the person you call. We know such people. This isn't something the church pays you to do. This is something that is a part of your life. And today I do this passage to honor those women in my life and those women in this body who've made this a part of their lives. By the way, I am blessed. I had a father and a father-in-law who are so committed to prayer. It was unbelievable. But the mothers and mother-in-law, why were they? I watched my dad and father-in-law start to preach. As soon as he started to preach, because you knew, you'd look at his wife and she started to pray. As soon as he started to preach, she started to pray. If there were the tough parts of the sermons, you could see her eyes closed. That's just what it was. And you see it was that combination, but you see as people like that you honor because you recognize they are godly women that God wants the church to be populated with. People are committed to God. People are committed to prayer. Notice this next with me. It's not only that, but notice this next part. Committed to her husband. Now, by the way, it needs to be here as we do this. I would see in this passage that what you're dealing with here is older women who, in fact, some of them, if you understand this, they may never have been married. For those who are married often had children and grandchildren to take care of them, and some of these didn't have anybody to take care of them. Some have equated to German where you do Frau and Fraulein. And you do the term broader for older women, whether they be married or unmarried. But whatever the case may be, it was people who are in need of this nature. But it's interesting, if they have a partner, they're committed to them. And it's fascinating because the term that is used is the same as with elders. Elders must be a one-woman man. A widow should be a one-man woman. Some people think that an elder can't be an elder if the wife dies and he marries again another godly woman. Now, go there if you want. I'm not going there. By the way, there's a dear, beloved lady. She's had three husbands die. And after the first one died, she married again. Second one died, she married again. And after three husbands like that, the single ladies in the mission field say, how come you can get three and we can't even get one? But make her less godly? No, 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 no. So crippled over, can hardly walk. But if you walk in the house, she just go over. She'd take care of you, my friend. She's a godly woman. Had three husbands, though. No, no, no. You see, the issue, by the way, I love the thing, and I think the positive side for you deal with elders. It is not just that you've lived with her for 40, 50, 30, whatever years it may be. It's that you're devoted to her. That's a big difference. I've watched men who've lived with people a long time, but they're not devoted to them. The elders were devoted to one woman, and these women were devoted to one man. Not that they couldn't be remarried or whatever, because even in this passage, the younger women are told, get married again. Nothing wrong with getting married. Just make sure that you are pure and devoted in the relationship that you have. So, it doesn't mean they'd never been married, but if married, they were committed to this man. Watch this. Committed to the children. Look at this. She's less than 60 years old, having been the wife of one man, having a reputation for good works. And do you know where the good works start? If she's brought up children. By the way, notice it starts with good works in the first of verse 10 and good work in the end of verse 10. That's what we call an envelope or inclusio. It's in the here. But the good work, the very first one, is the children. By the way, what goes on here? People have suggested that what happened later in the church is that they would often have the widows do orphanages, as if we pay you now that you're a widow so you can care for children. That's not what this is about. If God gave you children, how did you care for them? And if you didn't have children, how did you care for those orphans or children in the body? By the way, I could take you to Africa. Amazing. There was a lady who was so committed to orphans, single lady. She began doing this work, and the mission says, we think you ought to do something else. And she says, no, and if I have to do it, I'll quit the mission. She did. She died out there. Do you know what's amazing? There are doctors, there are politicians, there are school teachers. She's mother to all of them. They come back for a reunion, and they come to see mother who raised them. And they're dotted all over the country of Nigeria today, very prestigious people that she raised. You know, it's committed to the family. Watch this. Commit the body of Christ. Notice this next one, see. If she has brought up children, if she has shown hospitality to strangers. This is not, my friend, having parties. This is opening your house up to people that you do not know and letting them eat at your table, drink of what you have, sleep in your bed. This is the kind of stuff. This is dealing with strangers. These are people who traveled in those days and didn't have a place to stay, so these people put them up. She didn't just become hospitable. She washed the saints' feet. Why? Because you've come on a long journey like this. Now, I think of that because in Africa, they'd show up at our door, and one thing we'd have to do, because you don't have hot water in the tap, you'd start that fire under those three stones with a big, huge tub on top. You'd warm the water so they could take a bath. Well, you see, when you come on those dusty roads, you've walked so long, your feet are so dirty, the one thing they want to do is, the first thing they do is they sit you down and they put your feet in the water and they begin to wash your feet. Terrible job. But remember, Jesus did it. Humble job. A thankless job. Tough job, but a meaningful job. She cares for people. You know such people. Your mother was such a person. And certainly mine was. But notice the order. It's God. It's the husband. It's the children. It's the body. Don't ever forget it. You see, it starts in the home and it moves out. It does. If you don't care for the home, you're worse than an infidel, it says. Worse than an unbeliever. Begins there. May I just, in summation, just as we look at this, there's so much in this passage, by the way. I only deal with this part of it. By the way, it is interesting when you talk about the home. Go down with me to verse 14. See, I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, give the enemy no occasion for reproach. By the way, it says keep house. I need to talk to some of you younger men just for a moment. The rest of you can keep your ears closed. It's okay. It says to keep house. I'm going to look the term up in here. Just let me do it because it's in chapter 5, verse 14, is it not? It's interesting because in this passage, I wish to oikodespotain, be the despot of the house. Listen to me. Just one side note. I'm all of 19. My folks are in Africa. I'm down here in California going to college, and I decided to go up British Columbia to visit my family, my father's family. I walk into a home of a lady who's got to be close to 70. She'd been my Sunday school teacher. I am Donnie to her, right? I walk in the house, 19 years old. And this older lady says to me, Donnie, what am I to do? I'm the counselor here, right? Her husband, they owned the whole major city block downtown, and their huge store they had, then they leased out all the rest of it. And he had decided to retire, let his son run the business, and she says, he's come home, and now he's trying to run this house like he ran the business. What am I at 19 supposed to say to this dear older lady, right? Listen to me carefully. Be careful. It doesn't say keeper of the house. It's the despot of the house. Listen, there are some responsibilities she has and how things go there. And leave her be. It is a wise idea, by the way. And it's a biblical one at that. However you want to term this term, just understand that, okay? But it is God. It is the husband. It is the children. It is the body. May I take you here again? If this passage does anything to you, there's so many questions and it's just true. But the message can't be missed. You see, the strong relationship between this family of God and the many families of God that make up this family of God. Strong relationship. And you see, in light of this, how the family of God functions strongly affects how the families of God function. What we do here teaches people what to do there. But what they do there strongly affects what they do here. And so in light of that, I just say to you, as we go home, how one functions in the one strongly affects how he or she functions in the other. May God help us. As we look at a passage, and we don't know the whole story here. Nobody does. Nobody does. I would just say to you one thing. Some have suggested that what happens when this younger woman, they get married and therefore leave their faith, and they say the only reason it can be is because they married unsaved people. It doesn't say that in the passage. I would just add one more thing to this. Be careful what you commit to do as an individual. I don't think this passage is about a group of people in the church who became a part of a group that was isolated from the church and so forth and set apart to do all these jobs. That's not the point of the passage. The point of the passage is care for the people in need. That's the point of the passage, big time. Do it in the families. Do it in the family of God. But there were women who were younger. And they somehow thought it was a pious thing to do, to say, you know, I'm never going to get married. It wasn't like they made some statement for the church and so do it. But they made a commitment to Christ that they would stay celibate and that they would do this. But, you know, it wasn't what God intended for them. And I said it to the elders the other night. I say to you, be careful of what you push people to commit to do. Better not to vow a vow than to vow a vow and break it. I've watched people who vowed to go to the mission field when they were younger and then didn't go and feel somehow that they violated their commitment to God. My friend, don't force people into that kind of a position. So as you look at this passage, though, just remember the primary issue, twofold. Don't strongly rebuke but encourage, whether it be older men, younger men, older women, younger women. Second thing, honor widows or widows indeed, and today honor the memory, whether they be widows or not widows. Honor the memory of women who've committed their life to God and fixed their hope on Him. Honor women today and mothers who have understood the priority of prayer in their lives. Honor women today who have affirmed the primary commitment to the home. But then honor women who have extended their ministry beyond that to touch the body of Christ in such an impactful way. It's a great day. Honor those who are godly women indeed, if you will. Shall we pray?